has certain very basic characteristics. A soul has mind, intelligence, knowledge, nous. A soul has courage, the capacity to look out for one's interests, the capacity to defend oneself. And finally, the soul has appetites. It wants things. It wants food. It wants shelter. It wants companionship. It wants things. So Plato says this would be more or less typical of any soul. It has these three qualities. Now, virtue, in Plato's scheme of thing, equates to knowledge. To know this is to be virtuous. But by extension, it is a proper arrangement, for instance, if we're talking about the soul, of these three qualities, of reason, of courage, and of appetites. So an ideal polity would have farmers, persons marked fundamentally by appetites. The essential characteristic which they possess is appetites. And they would be permitted to own all the property, to have all of the fine things. In the second place, soldiers. People endowed particularly with courage. And they would defend the community. Did he have Sparta in mind when he was thinking about a property-less class of soldiers whose role is sort of corporately to defend the society? It's an interesting question, and it's hard to say. And finally, philosophers, who have such an elevated understanding that they felt a duty, not a desire, to serve those by leading who were committed to material things and to the exercise of physical skills. Now, you see, the point is that no one of us, as we exist in the world, is arrayed in just this way. We are each, as it were, imperfect manifestations of this transcendent soul, which would have these three qualities of reason, courage, and appetite absolutely properly arranged. So he says an ideal state would be one that matched this ideal soul. Well and good. That's what he says. Is there a state like that? No. Has there ever been one? No. Could there be? Yes. Because we could study this, we could understand this, and we could do it. But we're not likely to do so. Plato's greatest pupil, he had many, his greatest pupil was Aristotle. Aristotle came from the far north of the Greek world. His father was a doctor and had important ties to the Macedonian court. We'll talk about the Macedonians in the next lecture. At 17, Aristotle entered Plato's academy. He spent some time also as tutor to Alexander the Great. He lived in Ionia for a while after Plato's death. In about 335 BC, he founded his own school, the Lyceum, in Athens. So today, still in France, a school is a lycée. Aristotle learned a great deal from his master, and the differences between them should not be exaggerated, as has sometimes been the case in the past. Aristotle, like his master Plato, was a prolific writer, and also a rigorously systematic one, and also not a particularly elegant one. It's easiest to describe Aristotle's prose as a drum solo, and the drummer has one stick. Thump, 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 and it goes on. Now, I've probably offended all the Aristotelians among you, but reading Aristotle is not the same pleasurable experience as reading Plato. Aristotle is marked by what one scholar called as inspired common sense. He based his ideas on close observation and study, not on pure thought. His earliest work, his earliest important work, for example, was in zoology. His most durable work in the long run was in biology, which has been the despair of every high school student for 200 years. Perhaps we see there the influence of his father, the doctor. Hard to say. But we can also see the long reach of the Ionians, beginning with Thales. Aristotle returns, in a way, to that world out there, in a way that Plato spent most of his time on the world in here, the world in our heads. Aristotle turns back to the world out there. Now, Aristotle, for example, did not see change as illusory. He didn't see change as proof of the contradictory nature of being. That, for example, that if you plant an acorn and you get an oak tree, Aristotle says this is a perfectly natural process. This is not change. I don't have to explain that. Now, if I planted an acorn and grew a donkey, I would have a serious problem. I would now have a change, and I'd actually have something to explain. You see, earlier Greek thinkers had reflected on, for instance, planting a seed. If I plant a seed, it grows, it bears fruit, it withers, it dies, it decays. There seemed to be a progression, there seemed to be a cycle here. Was this change, was this natural, was this something that required explanation or not? Well, the problem of change, or perhaps you'll recall my saying the problem of motion, was one that taxed the pre-Socratic philosophers in Greece, all of those before Socrates, considerably. Aristotle says it's a non-problem, if you understand things correctly. Change is a natural process, and we can explain it, or he would have said alternatively, there's actually no such thing as change. Forms, he would have said, Plato's forms, have no existence separate from the things by which they are named. A chair is a chair is a chair is a chair. There's no such thing as chairness. We don't need that. What he's really saying is we don't need that concept. What we do is study closely things around us. And eventually we'll realize that we've got a whole lot of things we can call chairs, and that they aren't tables, that they aren't other kinds of things. Reality exists in the specific and the observable, but this requires close observation. Here he's very much like Herodotus, isn't he? I know what I've seen myself. Here he's very much like the medical writers. Well, his father's a doctor. Again, close observation. He had a profound love of order. For example, Aristotle classified all kinds of sciences, and he said that there are various branches of knowledge. There are the theoretical, those that aim at knowledge, purely. Practical, those that aim to improve conduct. Productive, those that aim at making beautiful and useful things. So he takes everything we know and he begins carving it up. He wrote on specific disciplines. He